Add a berry blast off for your day with the new Berry Pebbles. A berry twist on a classic breakfast. Perfect for giving those growing minds a blast of creativity. With the new Berry Way to Pebbles. Yabba dabba do you with Berry Pebbles. Head to postpebblescereal.com to learn more. Yabba dabba do and the Flintstones and all related characters and elements copyright and trademark Hanna-Barbera.
Listen closely. That's not just paint rolling on a wall. It's artistry. A master painter carefully applying Benjamin Moore Regal Select Eggshell with deftly executed strokes. The roller, lightly cradled in his hands, applying just the right amount of paint. It's like hearing poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
This is First Draft, a dialogue on writing. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. First Draft highlights the voices of writers as they discuss their work, their craft, and the literary arts. I want to take a moment to say I hope you are safe and healthy. Thank you for tuning in to this hour of togetherness where we discuss what unites rather than divides us. Coming up, an interview with Kwame Alexander, author of the poetry collection Light for the World to See.
I was in my own world and people were dancing and listening to a jazz band in the other room. I still remember it, but I didn't care.
We'll be back with Kwame Alexander in just a bit. Since this is my last podcast episode of 2020, I want to share a few statistics about First Draft. This year, I featured 51 interviews, one a week without fail. Of the 51 interview guests, 31 were women, 12 were individuals of color, one was transgender, one was non-binary, 7 identified as being in the LGBTQ community. 39 of the interviews focused on novels, 10 on short stories, and 3 on poetry collections. 6 nonfiction authors were featured, including 2 who wrote solely on the craft of writing. And I interviewed 10 authors who live in countries other than the USA. I hope I am representing a cross-section of our world, but I am eager to hear from you about what more I can do to represent a diverse roster of writers. I loved every single moment of the more than 75 hours of conversations I conducted and edited. I look forward to doing it again, and I couldn't have done any of it without my patrons. This is where I'm going to ask you for your support and to offer the bigger picture. This was a year of 51 interviews contributing to the last 7-plus years of producing First Draft, of which I have a total of over 315 interviews. This is a colossal effort, and it is indeed and without a doubt a labor of love, but there is also labor involved. Time and effort and a lot of planning and schedule wrangling across time zones worldwide. I emphatically believe that what I do, that what we create, the writers and I and you, the listeners, matters. There's an alchemy that happens with every single interview and every single production. So please, if you value this program, please consider becoming a contributing member by donating at www.patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. That's patreon.com. You can give any amount, but for just $6 a month, you will receive extras from the show, including ad-free, pitch-free episodes, cuts that didn't make it into the final show, writing tips, and more. I assure you, even $6 a month makes a huge difference to me and the production of this show. Each Patreon member keeps this show going, and it's here because of others like you who transformed from listener to supporter. It's such an amazing and simple way to continue discussions like the one you're about to hear and to keep art and its importance in our culture around the world alive through conversation. Whether this is your first listening experience or you have caught the more than 300 produced episodes, I am asking you with humbleness and appreciation if you would consider supporting First Draft. It's important for me to produce interviews with diverse writers and sometimes on difficult topics, which always add up to conversations which focus on what it means to be alive today. This effort takes money, time, equipment, organization, more late nights than you can imagine, and a lot of heart and sweat to come to fruition each week. I know there is so much free content out there. In fact, what you are about to listen to is free, but it is not without expense to make. Please beat the odds of having to listen to this 7 times before you join the First Draft community. Go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Any amount you donate will go to the continuation of these conversations focused on literary craft, content, and practice, as well as the culture we inhabit. Please stay tuned at the end of the show. I'll offer recommendations on an episode in the archive that is similar to the one you're about to hear. And please rate the show on iTunes and tell your friends to subscribe. But also, everyone, tell everyone. Tell your hairdresser, your mail delivery professional, your Lyft driver, your uncle's favorite restaurant's chef, your mother. Please tell them all to subscribe. And thank you for your support and for being here with me today, right now, in this moment. My guest today is poet, author, educator, and speaker Kwame Alexander. He has written 32 books, including The Undefeated, How to Read a Book, Swing, Rebound, and The Crossover, which won a Newbery Medal. Alexander is a regular contributor to NPR's Morning Edition and the recipient of numerous awards, including the Coretta Scott King Author Honor and the Lee Bennett Hopkins Poetry Prize. He is the founding editor of Versify, an imprint of Houghton Mifflin Harcourt Books for Young Readers, whose mission is to change the world one word at a time. His new poetry collection is called Light for the World to See, 1,000 Words on Race and Hope, which contains 3 poems and is a rap session on race. The Slim Collection is a lyrical response to the struggles of Black lives in our world. It has a very stylized graphic presentation and delves into our country's crisis of conscience and highlights the themes of loss, resilience, and hope. We began the discussion with me asking Kwame Alexander about the genesis of the collection.
I wanted to write a book that was a reminder to my daughter that if people view you as marginalized or disadvantaged or other or somehow un-American, it says more about them than it says about you. You must walk through this world believing that you matter. You must walk through this world not letting other people's no's define your yes. You have to remember that your ancestors came through tragedy and they triumphed. And how do we know they triumphed? Because you're still here, because you're here. And so I wanted to write a book as a reminder to Black Americans of their humanity, that they are human beings first and foremost. And I wanted to write a book that was a wake-up call to white Americans that, look, if you want a better future, if you want a world that's beautiful, if you want a world that is sort of representative of what the American dream is in all of its splendor and joy, then you got to acknowledge the trauma of the past. You got to know what went wrong, what we did wrong in order to sort of know how to move forward and do better. So that's a lot to sort of to put in a book. And of course, I believe that poetry is a tremendous way to immediately connect with people and help people become more connected to themselves, to each other, and ultimately help people become more human beings, more human, better human. You can talk about so much, so many heavy, weighty things in so few words, and that's the beauty of poetry. So I thought, well, this book will be, you know, short, concise, sparse, rhythmic, figurative, and hopefully, you know, my readers will be engaged by it, and hopefully, you know, be inspired and empowered by it.
The book is composed of 3 poems that are very They are spare and very lyrical. And so given what you just said about your intention for the book, I could imagine like going into it that maybe you felt a certain kind of pressure to find the right words. So I'm wondering how crafting these, like what kind of pressure you felt and if it was like a flow state or like serious rewriting and like your hand in your head sometimes.
So that's a beautiful way to put it. In that with poetry, it is all about the pressure of finding the right word. I remember I was talking to, I do a lot of school visits, or at least I did when the world was open, visiting students and talking about the power of poetry. And I remember one fourth grader, I asked her, what did she think poetry was? And she said, poetry is the right words in the right order. And I was like, yes. That's it. So this pressure is constant, consistent, and real when you're writing poetry. That is the pressure, to find the right word. And in addition to being the pressure, it's also the joy and the beauty of it. Like to be able to find that right word that's, you know, or two, that's going to jump off the page and make you feel something that you didn't feel before. Because as we know, poetry is not telling, it's showing. And so how do you paint that picture? So I think like all poets, I embrace that pressure. I love it. It's, you know, it's a beautiful thing. And it's ultimately what separates, you know, a poem from, you know, the telling of something. And that's why we do this work. So, you know, this book is under 1,000 words. And so every word counts, every word matters. And it can be literal, but most of the time it's gotta be figurative. You've gotta put me, the reader, in a position where I can, you know, where your personal becomes my business. And that's what I tried to do with this book and what I try to do with all of my poems is make my personal your business. So yeah, I love the pressure. It's a part of it. And I love it.
I'm curious about your desire to speak to children. I don't mean like literally go speak to them, but also speak to them through your work. Right. Because I know you write a lot of children's books and I gathered that your dad was a principal. So I'm wondering about that sensibility in you.
Both my parents were teachers and principals. And, you know, I feel like I'm a kid at heart. And I'm 52 and I still feel like I'm a kid. And sometimes I feel like I'm just sort of getting over in this adult body, living this adult life, because I just feel like such a goof, such an innocent purveyor of hope and joy and optimism. And, you know, I traffic in saying yes. Like I spend my life saying yes. And so I think the first and foremost, I still feel like a child, a kid in so many ways. And so I think my sensibilities in writing, you know, they reflect that need to want to write for my younger self, to want to write poems and stories and novels and books that I would have loved to have read when I was 10, 11, and 12. And that I love now. In a more concrete way, you know, my second daughter was born in 2008. And whereas prior to that, I've been writing a lot of love poems and suggestive love poems and just and that type of thing. When she was born, I began to read to her children's picture books by Mo Willems, Elephant and Piggy and Jacqueline Woodson. And so my sensibilities in reading began to change because I was reading to her. And then, of course, we all know that to become a really good writer, the way that we become better writers is by reading. And so my writing sensibilities began to change and I began to write more for her. And as she grew older, I began to write for her and her kid and her friends. but it seemed very natural to me because that was something that I was immersed in 24/7 with, you know, having a child. And then I think the last piece of it is, you know, being able, I think my first real writerly job was in Arlington, Virginia as a poet in the schools. And I got paid $25 an hour, which was a lot of money at the time. And it is now still probably. But it was 1 hour a day. So I'd be paid to go into high schools and read poetry to kids. And of course the kids were like, we don't want to hear a poet. That's boring. And the teachers were like, you know, yeah, this isn't going to work because we don't have success with Shakespeare and Robert Frost. So why do you think you're going to come in here and do something? And I'd go in and of course I'd share something accessible, relatable, cool, fun, the kind of poetry I loved reading, whether it was Langston Hughes or Pablo Neruda or E.E. Cummings, I Carry Your Heart in My Heart, or Nikki Giovanni. And the kids, would their eyes would light up. They'd be like, whoa, this is poetry? So all of those things sort of converged, and I just began writing and enjoying speaking to young people through verse on the page and the stage.
I think what's so interesting about that choice you made to speak to children, given some of the topics that you're writing about and thinking about and that you were talking about in the very beginning, is that I know for me, like, I think many, many, many of my values were shaped by reading as a child. And so you have this amazing opportunity to speak to children and help create this world that you want to see by shaping their views and their morals and the things that really touch them. And then at the same time, it must be really difficult to take these big adult concepts and make them tangible for kids.
Absolutely not. It's the opposite. I mean, the kids are already thinking about this stuff. They watch the news. They see the police officer's knee on the neck of the black man. You know, they're on lockdown. They can't go to school because of a pandemic. You know, they see the results of the election and the current president's refusal to concede. They see what's happening in the world. They aren't blind. So no, it's easy. Kids are already thinking about these things. They're talking about these things. They're watching it on television. They're listening to it. And so it's on us as the adults in their life, the teachers, the librarians, the writers the people who are doing this sacred work to help young people imagine a better world, is to paint a picture of the world that's accurate, that's truthful, that's real. Because the alternative is to dumb it down, to talk down to them, to assume that it doesn't matter to them, that what matters to them is Minecraft and Fortnite, and that's all that matters. Certainly those things matter, but they aren't the only things that matter, and kids are smart. And so I choose to speak to young people like they matter. I choose to speak to young people like I wanted people to speak to me, like I mattered, because I did. Because as an 11-year-old boy, I would go to sleep listening to WTAR 790 AM in Chesapeake, Virginia, which was the oldies but goodies station. And what 11-year-old listens to oldies but goodies? But I did, because I wanted to. I thought I liked this girl. I thought I was in love with her, and I wanted to hear old love songs. And she, I didn't think she liked me. And my favorite song was "Breaking Up Is Hard to Do." Now I know that it's true, and I'm an 11-year-old, but I'm not telling anybody this, but this is what I'm feeling. So, of course, I want to read a Pablo Neruda poem about love. Tonight I write the saddest lines. Like, of course I want to read it, but you're not going to think I want to read it because you think I only care about Atari or Commodore Vic. And any kid who's listening to this is going to have no idea what I'm talking about. So PlayStation and Xbox, that's the similarity. That's what it's akin to, listeners. But that's not all I care about. I care about the things that matter. I care about friendship. I care about love. I care about family. And so write to me about those things. And those are the things I want to write about. And those are the things I try to write about. the things that matter.
Because your poems are so short, I'm wondering if you'd be willing to read them and then we can talk about them.
I don't know if I want to read all of them, but or maybe I do. But let's start with one of them.
Sure. Why don't you pick which one?
I'll pick the one that was the most difficult to read, or rather the most difficult one to write, which I wrote after the killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis police officers. We can't see our home. We can't breathe the air. We can't break the chains. We can't run away. We can't speak our name. We can't keep our tongue. We can't learn to read. We can't sing a song. We can't be in love. We can't be a group. We can't shield our girls. We can't save our sons. We can't hold our own. We can't bend a knee. We can't take a stand. We can't save ourselves. We can't hold a gun. We can't stop that whip. We can't wear the skin. We can't hang ourselves. We can't run. We can't stay. We can't fight. We can't last. We can't vote. We can't voice. We can't whistle. We can't breathe. We can't breathe. We can't cross a bridge. We can't ride a bus. We can't be in church. We can't have a dream. We can't wear our skin. We can't wear a hood. We can't play our songs. We can't be ourselves. We can't be at home. We can't be alone. We can't be unarmed. We can't shoot ourselves. We can't hold a gun. We can't hold a toy. We can't hold a phone. We can't do a thing. We can't drive a car. We can't walk the street. We can't ride a bike. We can't run away. We can't be a boy. We can't be a man. We can't be afraid. We can't break these chains. We can't walk. We can't run. We can't breathe. We can't live. We can't breathe. We can't live. But we will not die. That's called American Bullet Points.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger. Feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volbella XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
You said it was the hardest to write. You definitely have a trope like the repeating about we can't that I would assume clearly comes from, you know, we can't breathe. But can you share more about, you know, all these feelings you had and how you alighted on sort of that rhythm and that those word choices?
Yeah, all three poems in Light for the World to See have that repetition, have that refrain, or have a refrain, have a certain kind of rhythm to it. And I tend to think that, you know, when you're using repetition in a poem, that it helps with emphasis. It helps with emphasis and really sort of drilling the point. And it becomes, you know, because of the rhythm of it, it becomes, for lack of a better word, entertaining. Or, you know, in a way that as the listener or the reader, you know sort of what to expect, but you really don't know what to expect. And so it helps you just keep turning the page. And I find that, you know, ultimately I want you to get to the end of the piece. And so those are some of the poetic devices that I chose to use, you know, in these three poems. But, you know, the idea behind all of these things we can't do, whether you're Ahmaud Arbery, and you're a teenage black kid living in Georgia, and you can't even go for a jog, you know, or you're Breonna Taylor, you can't even be in your apartment. And so all of these things that we can't do, it just made me start thinking about, you know, going back to the first Africans that were kidnapped and taken to America, and how they, you know, they could no longer see their country, their land, the shores where they walked. You know, they were not allowed to speak their language. They could not read. And so I just started thinking about all these things we can't do. And then it sort of dawned on me that, but wait a minute, each of these things we did. Well, we did learn to read. You know, we did gather and sing in churches. We did love. Like, we did. So it's sort of a juxtaposition of all the things that we've been told that we can't do. Yet you could easily substitute the word can in each of those lines because we did them. And so the hard part about it, writing that, this piece, was the ending. Because when I wrote that first draft of the poem, it was the last line was, but we can die. And then I got to thinking, talking to a couple of friends about it. And they were like, Carmen, you got to remember, we're still here. And so it just hit me, like Langston Hughes in his poem, I'm Still Here. No, but we won't die. All these things that we've been through, we are still here. We will not die. So it was, you know, I thought the poem was done when I wrote that first draft and had the ending, but it turned out it wasn't, that I had to sort of flip it on its head, and it gave a whole different kind of, you know, sort of feeling at the end of the poem. And I knew the poem would be dark, and I knew it would be sad, and I knew it would be, you know, traumatic, because those were the things that I was feeling. But ultimately, like I said, I'm a say yes person. I live in this space of hope. I'm an ultimate optimist. So if I'm gonna write something that's dark and depressing and traumatic, it's gonna have to end with some hope.
Yeah, I definitely felt that as I was reading it, you know, all these can'ts, and it's building, and it's like this litany, and it's this truth of the history. And then you see these last lines, and it's that change in rhythm, and there's no contractions, and it's really bold. Like, instead of all the things that can't, it's like, we will, and the survival and the hope was so wrapped up, not just in the words, but in the form.
Yeah, you summed it up perfectly.
So I'm curious about, because this book is, it's a very small, very beautiful book. It's black and white and yellow and orange and gray. And the type on some words, like we can't sing a song, is really big. And we can't be afraid takes up a whole page. And in some cases, like we can't breathe, you have we can't is small and breathe is big. So I envisioned that the layout of this was important, but I'm assuming you didn't write it this way. So I'm curious about that process.
Yeah. So the designer for the book, it's a South African artist. His name is Sindiso. And we sort of gave him free rein to visualize the words. And I feel like we gave him an audio of me, you know, reading the pieces. And it's important that in many of the books that I write, in particular this one, that the words on the page reflect the way I'd like you to hear them. I'd like you to read them. So yeah, so I think that you're spot on, that Sindiso, you know, he created a visual melody on the page, so that you could, as you're reading it, you can understand where the accent should go, where the emphasis should be, where the breath should come, where the the speeding up should occur. Like all that stuff, I think, went into it. Now, I don't know, you know, after we passed it on to him, we may have had a few edits after he sent back his initial sketches and so forth, but we let him do his thing. So you got two sort of pieces of art happening here. You got the words, and then you have the visual interpretation, almost like an expressive, like he took my words and created a piece of art based on and or inspired by another piece of art being my words. And I think he did an amazing job with it.
You open the book with sort of a letter called Freedom Now, and you're writing about an incident of yours in childhood in 1978, after there was a police killing of Arthur Miller, who was a Black civic leader. And you're going on this field trip, and you're scared at first. You're going with your school, and your dad is saying, you know, everyone's going, and you're scared because you've seen the violence. But when you get there, there's a reverend, and he's chanting, and you're chanting, you know, we're fired up. We can't take no more. We're fired up. We can't take no more, which is poetic in itself. And I was thinking about, you know, maybe that instinct for poetry was rooted in you in times like these, where you started off maybe one way and ended another.
Absolutely. I mean, you again, I think poetry in my life from a very early age, you know, it dictated my creative agenda for the years to come. I tell people all the time, I didn't find poetry, it found me. But, you know, you talked about what happened in 78 with the killing of Arthur Miller in Crown Heights, and which I talk about in the preface. But it started much earlier than that in terms of, and I couldn't articulate how much I loved poetry or how much it meant to me, but it started much earlier for me, you know, as a 2-year-old, as a 3-year-old, because my mother, we lived in New York City, and my parents were in graduate school at Columbia University, and they were studying to become educators. And they had sort of a focus on multicultural children's literatures, which meant that books were everywhere in my home. Like, I don't remember, you know, toys. I'm sure I had them. I don't remember, you know, what I ate. Obviously, I ate. But I remember the books. And at 3 years old, I remember Spin a Soft Black Song by Nikki Giovanni. I remember Dr. Seuss, Fox and Socks. And apparently it was my favorite book at that age, Fox, Socks, Knox, Box, Fox and Socks, Socks and Box. And I wanted to read it all the time. I wanted it to be read to. I memorized it. And so, you know, one particular day at school, at the end of the day, I had built a house out of blocks, and a classmate, another 3-year-old, had knocked over my house, and I was livid. I wanted to show my mom when she got to school what I'd done. And so I responded like as if those were fighting. He wanted to fight. And I responded with the only weapons I had. And I said, those were my blocks that you flipped. Lest you want a quick payback, better fix my quick block stack. And the kids started crying. And when my mom came to pick me up, the teacher said, Mrs. Alexander, we have a problem. Your son is arrogant. He intimidates the other kids with his words. My mother said, thank you. We teach him to use his words. So I think for me, poetry has just always been a part of it's been the language that I've learned to communicate in, to the language that has built confidence in me, the language that allowed me to find my voice, the language that allowed me to know my worth. And it continued, you know, throughout my schooling and my childhood. And so when I heard on the Brooklyn Bridge in 1978, with, you know, hundreds of other classmates who were marching with me to protest police brutality, when I heard, "We're fired up, we can't take no more. We're fired up, we can't take no more." That was that refrain of resistance. That was that poetic, you know, moment that built confidence in me, that allowed me to stop crying and feel like, okay, this is gonna be okay. I think literature has done that for me throughout my life. And so when I write, you know, ultimately, I am trying to do the same thing. I am trying to empower. Yeah, I gotta write it in a way that's entertaining, but ultimately, I think I'm just trying to teach.
You know, it sounds like your parents being these educators and having such a big influence on your reading life and you writing this from your daughter. I see this strong family ethic really there. And I was curious about your parents, maybe. How did they meet and where did they grow up?
They met at Norfolk State University in college. My mother passed away 3 years ago, so I could probably tell this story. And she wouldn't, you know, she obviously won't know about it. But they met because my father was a basketball star, pretty popular dude. My mom was beautiful and brilliant. And he was on the phone talking, on a payphone, talking to one of his girlfriends. And he had been talking forever and she needed to call home. And she had been waiting in line to talk. And she just got frustrated. So she went up to the phone booth and she said, "Honey, come on. Let's go, love." And she said that so that his girlfriend could hear. And apparently the girlfriend hung up and he got off the phone. And that was how they met, which I find to just be hilarious and such, you know, what a great story. So, you know, that's how they met. And then they, after, you know, finishing college, my mother probably would have stayed in Norfolk, Virginia. My father had big plans and big dreams. He wasn't as smart as my mother. And he had, there had been a notice on the bulletin board that Columbia University was offering scholarships for Black students who met a certain criteria. And of course that's in New York City. And he told her she should apply. This is after they had begun dating. And she was like, no, I'm good. I'm going to teach here in Norfolk. And he said, no, you gotta take this opportunity. And she finally, he coerced her into applying. And she knew she wasn't going to do it, but she got accepted. And she got the full ride, and then he convinced her to take it. He's like, "Well, you got it. You got to take it now." And so she left, and he had another year in school, and she went to Columbia University, and the next year he followed in the doctoral program, and that was the beginning. I grew up in the dormitories, you know, at Columbia University as a 2 year old. So I grew up around this very literary, artistic, academic, literacy environment. I think, like I mentioned earlier, there were times where I wanted to be a doctor or I wanted to be a tennis star, you know, in college. But I think this was definitely destined for me to figure out a way to change the world one word at a time.
I feel good. Dad,
are you singing to your cereal?
Yes, I am, like I knew that I would.
No, a dance too?
Come on, Ava. Silk almond milk. Starts the morning on a high note. Yow!
Songs, dances, and dad jokes?
So good! So good! I got you!
Silk almond milk.
With calcium, vitamins A, D, and E.
Feel plenty good.
Gravity had a good run, but it's time to feel the weightlessness of the Brooks Glycerin 21. These running shoes feature nitrogen-infused DNA Loft V3 cushioning. Brooks has even magnified the plushness to elevate the softness to new levels. And if you want extra support, find these same features in the Brooks Glycerin GTS 21. Learn more and shop now at brooksrunning.com. That's brooksrunning.com.
I saw that that you first performed these poems on ESPN's The Undefeated. I don't know what that website is, but I thought that was interesting.
TheUndefeated.com is a website that Kevin Merida is the editor and producer of, and it's an online destination that's the intersection of race, sports, and culture. And when they were launching in 2016 or 17, I had known Kevin from his days at the Washington Post. He was a managing editor there. And when they were launching TheUndefeated.com, he said, "We need a poem to help launch The Undefeated. Can you write one?" And I knew that I thought, yeah, why not? And he said they were going to produce a video of the poem. And I thought, great. And there was a poem that I had written 7-8 years prior when Barack Obama was elected president. And it was a poem called An American Poem, which sort of detailed the history of Black people in America as a way of writing a biography of America for my then newborn daughter to show her how we got to this point where we now have a Black president. So I tried to write it from the first Africans, you know, being kidnapped and unloaded in Jamestown to, you know, November 2008 when Obama was elected. And so I wrote this long, epic poem. So when he called, I thought, I'll take that poem and rework it because it has some of the things I'd want to talk about. And it just went over. The video went viral, and we had a great time with that. And Margaret Ramo, who is my editor at Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, she said, "Kwame, that poem should be a book." And I thought, well, fine, let's do it. I had never thought of it as a book. It was a poem. And she got in touch with Kadir Nelson, who's a pretty acclaimed illustrator and portrait artist. And he does a lot of the New Yorker covers. And he loved it, and he wanted to illustrate the book. So it ended up being published as a children's book. The second thing that happened, and it ended up winning the Caldecott Medal, which is for the most distinguished illustration for a children's book in America. And it won a Newbery Honor. So my editor, Margaret, had some vision. She has serious vision. The second thing that happened is I was in Florida, and between 2015 and 2018, I probably visited about 1,500 schools, performing for students, presenting poetry, talking about the power of literature. At one particular school, we were in Florida. I was with my guitarist. I traveled with a guitarist named Randy Preston, and we were in Gulfstream, Florida. And I think it was a Sunday, and I had seen and read and heard about Colin Kaepernick taking a knee and just the uproar. And I thought, really, over taking a knee, people are upset at this silent protest, this nonviolent protest? And I ended up writing a poem called Take a Knee, and just how and what it means to take a knee and how absurd the resistance to taking a knee is. And then, of course, finally, George Floyd, the video surfacing of his killing, of his brutal killing. And I couldn't watch the video, but I needed to write about it. And so I ended up writing a piece called American Bullet Points. So all three of these pieces, 2008, 2016, 2020, earlier this year, Margaret Ramo said, "Kwame, I think these three poems should be a book, and you should write an introduction to it." And of course, that was her vision, and it came into fruition with Light for the World to See.
I'm wondering if you want to talk about one of the other poems and or read it. You don't have to, but I'd love to talk about it either way.
The Undefeated. This is for the unforgettable, the swift and sweet ones who hurdled history and opened a world of possible. The ones who survived America by any means necessary, and the ones who didn't. This is for the undeniable, the ones who scored with chains on one hand and faith in the other. This is for the unflappable, the sophisticated ones who box adversity and tackle vision, who shine their light for the world to see and don't stop till the break of dawn. This is for the unafraid, the audacious ones who carry the red, white, and weary blues on the battlefield to save an imperfect union, the righteous marching ones who sang, "We shall not be moved because Black lives matter." This is for the unspeakable. This is for the unspeakable. This is for the unspeakable. This is for the unlimited, unstoppable ones, the dreamers and doers who swim across the big sea of our imagination and show us the majestic shores of the promised land. This is for the unbelievable, the we real cool ones. This is for the unbending, the black is the night is beautiful ones. This is for the underdogs and the uncertain, the unspoken but no longer untitled. This is for the undefeated. This is for the undefeated. This is for you and you and you. This is for us.
So it's such a poem of unity and bringing people together. And the note you wrote in the book was that you wrote it in D.C. in 2008 after the birth of my second daughter and the election of Barack Obama as the 44th president of the United States of America. Was this one that you thought about a lot before you put your pen to paper? Did it? What was the creation process like for this one?
Oh my goodness. Yes. This was so in my sort of dream of dreams, I'd hoped that one day I'd be invited to deliver the inaugural poem at a presidential inauguration. You know, I wanted to do what Maya Angelou had done for Bill Clinton. And of course, you know, that's such a grandiose dream that's probably never going to happen, but I always thought it's going to happen one day. So when Barack Obama was elected, I thought, this is going to be my time, my chance. And I remember being contacted by some organ, and of course I wasn't going to be, you know, the inaugural poet because that was Richard Blanco. But I remember being contacted by some organization and they were having an inaugural ball. And of course everybody was, there were so many inaugural balls. There was the main one, but there were so many balls happening. And one of the groups contacted me and they asked me to write an inaugural poem. And I thought, yes, finally, my day has come. I'm going to be writing an inaugural poem for like the 47th inaugural ball that's happening that day. And so I spent a lot of time trying to write it in a way as if I was delivering it at the inaugural inauguration. And I spent a lot of time trying to figure out how I am going to write this in a way that my daughter will be able to listen to it and hear the rhythm and repetition that will keep her engaged as, you know, a 6-month-old. Because she isn't going to understand the words. So I spent a lot of time figuring out how to make it historical. And I spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to make it, you know, figurative and how to make it poetic. So a lot of time went into it, absolutely. And it was one of the longest poems I had written. I think the original version of it was probably about 1,000 words. And this version now is obviously a fraction of that. But once I figured out that, you know, what the refrain, as it were, was going to be, what the repetition was going to be, then it was just a matter of telling a story. And I think ultimately all three of these poems are this, they have that beginning, middle, and end. They're telling you that story for sure.
What did it feel like when you were at the ball reading this?
I was in heaven. I was in my element. I was delivering what I thought was going to be the, you know, this literary, you know, moment, this defining literary moment in our country. And so I was in my own world, and people were dancing and listening to a jazz band in the other room. I still remember it, but I didn't care. There were 30 or 40 people watching and listening to me. I was on stage, and people were eating and dancing, and it felt right. And it felt, again, I don't write for applause, acceptance. I write to inspire and engage and entertain and empower. And so, but it's got to do that for me. And every time I read that poem, just like I, you know, just read it with you, I am inspired. I am ready to take on the day. I'm ready to get back out into the world and be, you know, as my preschool teacher said, I'm ready to be arrogant in my, and when I say that, let's be clear, not in this, I'm not being arrogant in the sense that you're not, I'm better than you. No, I hope you're arrogant in who you are. We can all be arrogant. There's this great quote that I, you know, discovered while I was researching the most recent book I wrote on Muhammad Ali called Becoming Muhammad Ali. And the quote goes like this: I am the greatest, not because I am better than anyone, but because no one is better than me.
In the preface to this, you wrote about that day when you went to this march and that you were wondering if the chance that you had that day were strong enough to carry the weight, and if words are strong enough, and that this book is your attempt to answer that question. It's you lifting up your voice and saying something about racism. And I'm wondering how you want people to read this, or if you're hoping that it will have a certain consequential impact on people's lives.
Everything I write, I am hopeful that it has a consequence, that it has a positive influence. Again, my goal is to change the world one word at a time, and now that's pretty lofty. But I ultimately want, you know, young people, I ultimately want readers to be moved in some, you know, profound, significant, meaningful way. I want you to feel something. I believe if you're going to think differently, you got to feel differently. If you're going to act differently, you got to think differently. Like, I want people to change for the better. I know what reading a good book does for me. I know what writing a good poem does for me. I want that to happen to everyone. Yeah, that's what I want. I'm not just writing for you to enjoy a story. So it doesn't matter what book it is, whether it's Light for the World to See or any book. I still want the same impact. I want to have the same impact. And I don't want to be didactic. You know, so that's where the craft part comes in. Like, I want to be a good writer so that you actually can get through the book and don't feel like you've been lectured. But yeah, ultimately, I want to teach, you know, I want to teach in a way that my mom taught me. I want to teach people to use their words to find their voice, to lift their voice. Absolutely. That's what I want from all of my books. And I want you to, you know, on another level, I want you to say, man, it's over. Oh, I want to read it again, or I got to go get another book. I want you to put down the book and I want to pick up another one. I want it to be contagious.
In the very beginning, you said that this was really, you were writing this for your daughter. And I'm wondering about her reaction.
Well, it's you know how kids are. They claim they're not interested, or you're not cool. And then, you know, something will happen and you'll get a glimpse that, oh my gosh, they were paying attention. I gave a speech once at the International Literacy Association, and it was about 5,000 teachers and librarians and media specialists in you know, the Boston Convention Center. And I'm giving this speech, and my daughter's in the front row. And maybe she was 7 at the time. And during the speech, I'm talking about books and growing up with books, and how when I was 11, my dad made me read his dissertations, and I began to hate books. And I said, and then one day I discovered Muhammad Ali's autobiography called The Greatest, and I could not put it down. It's 400 pages. And it reinstilled this love of literature that I, you know, because I had fallen out of love with books because my dad was making me read this stuff that I didn't want to read. And so I wasn't reluctant. I wasn't interested. There's a difference. And so in the moment that I sort of have this realization on stage, I say books are amusement parks. And sometimes kids got to be able to choose the ride. And I'm like, wow, that was pretty great. That's it. And for the rest of the conference, people are using my quote. It's on slides. It's become this thing. And maybe about a month or two. And so my daughter's like, after it's over, my daughter's like, can we go eat lunch? Cool. About a month or so later, we're on a flight to Singapore. I'm going to speak at a school in Singapore. And we're on a flight. And it's 11, 12-hour flight. And I say, look. And she immediately sits down and she's looking at all the movies and games. And I'm like, turn it off. You cannot watch it until you, you know, read an entire book. And she pulls out a graphic novel. And I say, that's not going to work. You're going to need to read some nonfiction or novel. And she looks at me in the middle of this flight and she says, Dad, I thought books were amusement parks and kids got to be able to choose the rides. And I just crack up. And I'm just laughing, and because what can I say? And I say, all right, go for it. So it is my hope that my kid is learning a great deal, and it is, and from my writerly life, and I suspect that she is.
Well, she's your daughter.
Indeed she is.
I mean, I could hear your spirit in her.
Right? She gets it honest.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you can read a passage from an author that speaks to you or influenced you as a writer.
I went down to the river. I sat down on the bank. I tried to think but couldn't, so I jumped in and sank. I came up once and hollered. I came up twice and cried. If that water hadn't been so cold, I might have sunk and died. But it was cold, cold in that water. It was cold. I took the elevator 16 floors above the ground. I thought about my baby and thought I would jump down. I stood there and I hollered. I stood there and I cried. If it hadn't been so high, I might have jumped and died. But it was high up there. It was high. So since I'm still here living, I guess I will live on. I could have died for love, but for living, I was born. Though you may hear me holler, as you may see me cry, I'll be dogged, sweet baby, if you're going to see me die. Life is fine. Fine as wine. Life is fine. Langston Hughes, poem called Life is Fine, been tremendously inspired, as many writers and poets and people have been, by his verse.
Can you read something you wrote? Maybe it was tricky or hard or changed a lot from the first draft.
So there's this thing called a reverso poem where you write it and you can read it different ways. You can read it back. You can read it forwards. You can read it backwards. And so at the end of the Becoming Muhammad Ali novel, which I wrote with James Patterson, there's a poem called Amen, Amen, Amen. And I wrote it as a reverso poem. Granddaddy Herman, because of you, I know who I am, I know whose I am, and I know where I'm going. I hope you can see that your words changed me, and I remember you told me I am the greatest, not because I am better than anybody. I am the greatest because nobody is greater than me. I'm going to win the Golden Gloves, even though I'm the underdog. I've been training my body and my mind, and tomorrow's the real beginning for me. I guess I just wanted to say thank you, and that even though I haven't been back here since the funeral, I think about you all the time, and I love you, Granddaddy Herman. And that's the forward way of reading a poem that young Cassius Clay wrote about his grandfather. And this is me reading it backwards. I love you, Granddaddy Herman, I think about you all the time and the funeral. Even though I haven't been back here since that, I guess I just wanted to say thank you. And tomorrow's the real beginning for me. I've been training my body and my mind, and even though I'm the underdog, I'm going to win the Golden Gloves because nobody is greater than me. I am the greatest, not because I am better than anybody. I am the greatest. You told me, and I remembered. Your words changed me. I hope you can see that I know where I'm going. I know whose I am. I know who I am because of you, Granddaddy Herman. Amen, amen, amen. Oh my God, that poem took 7 days to write because you got to get it exactly right so that it does, so that it makes sense.
Where do you write?
When the world was open, I would write. I live in London. So I would write at a cafe in London called Raoul's. I would write at a tea house in Soho. I like writing. I like being around people. I like eavesdropping. You know, I wrote in the park. Now I write in my flat. I write inside because, you know, the world is shut down and I want to be safe.
And what do you do or where do you go to get away from writing?
I walk a lot. You know, there are a lot of parks in London, Hyde Park, Regent's Park. I do a lot of walking and I love walking. When I'm walking, I'm listening to podcasts or listening to an audio book or just thinking. When the world was open, I definitely would go to the beach. The beach is a place I love to be at. And of course, one of the places I frequent is a place called Netflix.
Who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
I will read it to my daughter and my wife. I will read passages to them and get their feedback. Not the whole thing, but I'll read passages. And then there's a group of people, a group of writers, who I'll share a draft with after it's done, before I send it to my editor.
How have you dealt with rejection?
Dribble, fake, shoot, miss. Dribble, fake, shoot, miss. Dribble, fake, shoot, miss. Dribble, fake, shoot, swish. When you're a writer, when you're an artist, when you're a human being, rejection is a part of it. My first novel got rejected 23 times. I do not let other people's no's define who I am. I just try to keep believing in myself, even when conventional wisdom is saying, no, not gonna work, nobody's in, nobody's down for it. I believe if you say it 12 times, believe it 12 times, your heart will catch up. You'll feel it. I just do it. I practice saying yes constantly. I practice walking through doors, even when I don't know what's on the other side.
What is your favorite word?
Yes. Yes.
Thank you so much for your time and your honesty and enthusiasm. I really, really appreciated talking to you.
As did I. This has been great. I appreciate this.
You've been listening to First Draft, a dialogue on writing. My guest was Kwame Alexander, author of the poetry collection Light for the World to See. If you like today's show, check out my interview with poet Erica Meitner, whose collection Holy Moly Carry Me focuses on race, a white mother parenting a black son, gun violence, and perseverance. You can find that interview in the entire First Draft archive of more than 280 interviews at firstdraftwriters.com. You can stay tuned to First Draft on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just look for First Draft ADOW. You can email me at firstdraftwriters@gmail.com anytime. Remember, there are plenty of extras for becoming a member and donating to First Draft, including access to pitch-free, ad-free content, as well as cuts from the interviews that didn't make it into the final show, writing tips from my guests, books, and more. I can't tell you enough how much each and every single dollar counts to keeping this show alive. The first tier of support is just $6 a month, so please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Coming up in the next few months on First Draft, interviews with Ben Okri, Mark Wunderlich, and Jamie Harrison. I want to send out a huge thank you to my patrons for making this interview happen. Your support makes First Draft, a dialogue on writing, a reality every week. Please stay healthy and safe. May 2021 be the beginning of better days for the world at large. The theme music for First Draft was produced and performed by Murph Mahaffey. I'm your host and producer, Mitzi Rapkin. Thank you for listening.